Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro.
So I guess after all this time, we should probably reintroduce ourselves. Yes, that's right. We are back and you are listening to the Decibel Geek Podcast. My name is Aaron Camaro. I'm pleased to make your acquaintance or reacquaintance once again. And as always, you know me, I'm joined by my awesome friend and kick-ass co-host, the one and only Chris Sinzak. What's going on, brother? How you been?
Oh, I'm good. It's nice to meet you finally.
Yeah, it seems like So basically, we blew up Kissmas in July. That's done. We're never doing that again. I'm thinking like Kiss Madness in March. Or something like that.
Who knows?
You know, we got to make repercussions for this, you know, somehow or another way. But we shouldn't be doing that in July anymore. I've learned the last few years, and this year has proved it beyond a doubt.
Yeah, it's we've had a long time off. There's been a lot going on. Obviously, Rockin' Pod, we had to deal with, and we got through it, and it was great. And we will do a full recap episode in the future, but not now because my wife's not letting me talk about it really. So.
Yeah, well, and the other thing, too, we blew up was our 10-year anniversary, so I guess somewhere down the line, we'll celebrate that as well. But yeah, Decibel Geek, decade of it.
Yeah, this year is our 10th year. I mean, we passed the official date already, but yeah, we're right around the time where you came on board in the year, I think. I think it was around...
We're so busy, we can't even celebrate our 10-year anniversary.
We should do it soon. I mean, and that would... I think a live stream would be good for that with friends coming on, but...
That's a good idea.
But yeah, it's been very busy, a lot going on, a lot of recovery time from the expo and everything, and... but yeah, we'll go into detail about that later, but you are going to, you know, get one of the great benefits of doing Rockin' Pod today, because we have an amazing interview with, Carmine Appice and Vinny Appice that Aaron and I did live in front of an audience at, SIR in Nashville.
Man, it was so awesome. Laura welcomed us into legendary SIR, showed us some amazing relics of rock and roll history. Then we got to go into the back room where the brothers are doing their master class, and we're seeing them interact with young drummers and, you know, fans and people that idolized them. You know, it was really cool to see these people that, you know, went the extra mile to be a part of that special thing on Sunday, and got to meet some amazing people down there, got to meet up with some of our friends and hang out and have a great time. And like Chris said, when it was all said and done, we sat down on stage, we had everybody pull their chairs up nice and close, we kind of sat around campfire style and shot the breeze with the Brothers Appice, and it was awesome. These guys are amazing, and they were so cool that day. We thought, you know, we got to record this, we got to share this with the people. So making our grand return to the podcast waves, we're back. And we're more dedicated than ever. So if you're a Decibel Geek VIP, get ready. I've got some stuff coming your way. If you're a Kiss fan, the Torpedo Dudes is coming back. Stay tuned for that. As always, we every so often do Friday Night Live, normally with our friend Rockin' Ron Runyon. Man, our hearts and minds and prayers and everything that we can give is going out to Rockin' Ron right now. This episode dedicated to him. He made it all the way from Colorado to Nashville to be at Rockin' Pod this year. And that in itself was a miracle, because Ron, Man, at first, he wasn't doing so great. But man, after a little while, he warmed into it and was having a great time, and everybody was so happy that he came. But we're going to give you the whole recap of the whole weekend coming up, maybe next week, maybe the week after, because we got some cool things we want to share with you. And we're going to start it out right here with this one. From SIR Studios, live in front of a studio audience, Chris Sinzak, Aaron Camaro, the Decibel Geek Podcast, and we're talking to the Appice Brothers. Enjoy.
We do it in a clean way. We are recording, so let's make sure we...
Yeah, okay. Can you make a little louder? I don't have my hearing aids in now. I should put them in.
What? Huh? Yeah, make this louder, too. Make this louder than his...
You know, last night we went... This is funny. Last night we went to San DeGennaro's house. So being a drummer for 40, 50 years, you eventually lose your hearing, the top end from the cymbals. So I had my hearing aids in. Sandy had his in, and my buddy Crazy Dwayne, that old guy that was hanging out with me, he used to play with Cactus, he had hearing aids too. So we go outside, and I'm hearing all these crickets, man. They're like loud as shit.
Oh, yeah, the cicadas.
So, Vinny, you hear the crickets? No. You don't have the hearing aids.
I don't need to hear the fucking crickets.
I think you made out better than they did.
Yeah, that's right.
What are we going to do with the crickets?
Now, I took them out, and I said, wow, I can't hear nothing. You know? I couldn't hear anything. I was like dead. Anyway.
All right. Well, Aaron, you wanna lead us off here?
That's the hazard of the career.
Yeah.
But man, your deafness.
But I could hear somebody playing.
Oh, that's better.
I could hear somebody playing out of tune.
Yeah.
I could hear the wrong notes they're hitting. I hear everything that way. I can't hear the crickets, but I could hear the band.
Sometimes you talk to Vinny and go, what? 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 I'm sure you guys had experience with that already. Anyway,
nice.
Let's move.
All right. So we were talking a little bit before we got started here. I'm Aaron Camaro. This is Chris Sinzak. We're from the Decibel Geek Podcast. Chris Sinzak put together this whole weekend for the Rockin' Pod and what you've got going on here today. Saw some of you guys up here playing drums with the brothers, man. I think, so you ask these guys, what did you do today? Holy shit, let me tell you. But it was amazing, man. How does it feel to do these things like this and have like the cream of the crop of your fans come out and want to be immersed in what you do? I mean, that's got to be an amazing feeling, right?
What'd you say?
Hey, my name is Aaron.
This is great doing this stuff because you really get to hang out with people. You get to, like a lot of you guys we met yesterday. And it becomes like friends, you know. It's really cool, and
it really started when we started doing drum clinics. You know, my first drum clinic was 1972.
Oh wow!
You know, and you get to really meet
BC.
Fans. What?
BC.
What? BC. Vinny always practices his stand-up at these things.
Yeah.
You know?
I'm getting that feeling.
It's pretty good.
Stand up and shout.
Yeah, you know,
new comedy routine, stand up and shout.
Yeah. We play that in our Drum Wars show. We play it together.
Nice.
And, man, that thing kills.
Yeah.
You know, really, really great. And Ronnie, you know, was a friend of mine. I knew Ronnie before Vinny did from the old days when he was playing the Elf and played with Deep Purple, and I was playing with Cactus, you know, and that's when I met him. I was asked to join Rainbow with Richie Blackmore when Ronnie's with.
Wait a minute! You got to answer his question.
What's the question?
When were you asked to join
Rainbow?
What
was it like to do
What was it like? I'm sorry.
I said do it was these great. Things.
I said great. It's like doing drum clinics, you know, from 1972. Getting to meet people. And when we went to see that thing with Joe Morello, as I talked about before, Vinny was like that big, pulling my pants. Aunt Carmen, you go play with him. I said, no, Vinny, you play with him.
No, but that's because I was hungry. I wanted to go have a sandwich.
You get to hang out with the people and the fans and that have been following you. That guy, that little guy with the glasses, that balding guy.
Yeah.
This guy goes to every gig in the Midwest that we do.
Nice.
We've been seeing him what, 10 years, 15 years, every gig. He just went to a bunch of Vinny's gigs. He's going to my gigs. He's telling me, you're going to be at the Token Lounge. I said, I am? Are you sure that's not Vinny? I think it's you. You're playing.
I think it's us too, but later.
Yeah.
Later. He's not coming to any gigs because Carmine called him bald and he left.
He left.
Yeah, just now.
Well, can we get back to the Deep Purple story? Because I want to hear that now.
Rainbow.
Rainbow, I'm sorry.
Yeah, oh, so Richie, I knew Richie from, you know, Vanilla Fudge days, and he said, he called me, or his, one of his representatives called me and said, Richie wants you to play with Rainbow. And I said, who's in it? He said, Ronnie Dio and Bob Daisley and all these good guys. And I said, oh, man, I'm signed to MCA Records. I'm doing this record called KGB with Mike Bloomfield. You know, and in those days, once you signed to a label, it was a main, you know, like a major label, you can't just leave and go sign with somebody else. It happened to me again when I had King Cobra. John Sykes and David Coverdale asked me to join Whitesnake just before they did that huge record.
Wow, yeah.
And I said, I can't do it because I got King Cobra. I got my own snake to deal with. And then I said, why don't you get Ainsley Dunbar or somebody like that? And they got Ainsley, and they sold 27 million albums.
Yeah. Wow.
And I went,
oh,
yeah. Wow. But you never know, you know.
The business.
It's the music business.
Yeah. Can't predict those things.
Yeah. I wanted to know, I had to think about this before we got, was there ever a point in time where you both were, like, your respective bands you were in actually toured together?
No, the closest we've been was he was playing with Ozzy in Europe, and I was playing with Dio.
Mm-hmm.
And we were kind of on the same routes.
Same buildings.
Different times, right. 2 days ahead, 3 days ahead. So we started writing on the wall. Hey, Carmine.
Vinny, welcome.
And we go to the dressing room. Hey, there's a good message from Carmine. Yeah. And he'd go and see.
And in those days, you didn't have cell phones to say, hey, Vinny, check out the message.
I was texting in the dressing room. It was just right on the wall.
You couldn't do that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's too funny.
But we never played together with the band.
Never on the same bill. Gotcha. Oh, man.
Only time we did that, really, is at some clinics. And when we started doing the Drum Wars thing, and that's a lot of fun because we do all, you know, both of our songs that were hits, and some of them we play together, some of them we play individually, and then we do stuff like we just did with the drums in between it all, and it's a really a different kind of show, you know.
Yeah. How did the Drum Wars idea kind of take shape, and when did you guys decide to start doing those?
It started from a clinic.
Clinic tour.
We had clinic
tour
booked back in
88.
Back way back when.
Yeah, 1988.
And Sabian put it on, and we did a drum clinics together. Well, we didn't know what we were doing. We just did our respective thing, and God knows what it, if we.
And then we'd play at the end like we just did a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have anything. And then.
But it went very well, and then we figured
and then we had a
to
family,
do more, but we didn't have time to do it after that.
We had a family business of a video company called Power Rock Videos, and you know, we had done some clinics and, you know, different people's clinics, Slim Jim Phantom and Tristan Bowden and people like that. And then I said, man, we should do a Drum Wars clinic. And whoever wins the Drum War wins the name, a piece or apathy.
Well, I explained to you how that came about before.
Yeah, you heard that, how that happened. So anyway, so we're doing it. But we really didn't know what the hell we were doing. You know, so we just had a friend of ours came with a video camera and followed us around. We said we put little skits together, like they put me in a chair with shaving cream on, and Vinny was coming at me with two razor blades. I'm going to shave my mustache off, you know. Stupid stuff, you know. And then we went to the Rainbow, and we'd ask them, hey, who do you think is going to win? You know, and some people say, Vinny's going to win, Carmine's going to win. And somebody flips a coin, it falls on the floor, and heads it's Vinny, tails it's me, and it's Carmine, you know, it's just stupid stuff, you know. And then we did the preliminary. We played with Jennifer Batten and Alfonso Johnson, right? Wasn't, you know. And we did The Ocean, you know, by Zeppelin.
Nice.
And we played it together. And then it went back to the silliness of the video. And then after the video, at the end, we had this chick who was on Eyewitness News, Francesca Cappucci, her name was. And she was, she had the mic that said Power Rock News on it and all that. It was really hilarious. So then at the end, my older brother Frank calls in
So we said, oh, here comes Frank on a satellite phone. You could tell it's a regular phone where you push the button in an office, you know.
And then sound effect.
And then he says, they're both wrong. It's a peach. So she said, oh, my God. So we've been doing all this for nothing. It's a peach. So that's how we ended it, you know. And then we did some clinics together. So I said, well, why don't we try and put a show together? Let's do a clinic show. And then let's do a regular show, you know. So we tried.
We did the clinic stuff, and then we realized, well, you really can't play a drum clinic at a club or something with people drinking. It's pretty boring.
Right.
So we decided to make it more of a show and add the band and all the music from our histories.
Yeah.
So we play about 12 songs in the set and drum bits and some.
It really developed in Europe. We went to Europe and did, I don't know how many shows in that first tour, like 20 shows. And then we'd say, you know what? We should do Mob Rules, you know, the band. You guys know it? Yeah, okay, we'll play it together. And then we did something else, and we kept adding stuff, subtracting stuff. And we turned it more from a drum show, like a clinic kind of drum show, into a rock show.
Yeah.
And we've done.
Yeah. We played a place up in Dickinson, North Dakota or South Dakota, some Dakota, and before we got there, they did a subway contest.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Carmine had the... said, Carmine, vote now for Carmine's tuna fish sub. And I was the meatball sub. I swear to God, I thought I was going to win. I lost.
Yeah. Oh.
People voted, and it was on the subway
tuna fish
sign.
All the way.
Wow.
I mean, that's the highlights.
Yeah. It was fun.
Man, what a cool city. I want to go there.
We have a good time doing it, and... And then we do the meet and greets after the show, and we meet a lot of the fans. You know, it's really great to see fans like that have been following us our whole career. You know,
there was a gentleman at the expo yesterday who he pulled out a Vanilla Fudge songbook
the guy with that looked like Duck Dynasty.
Yeah, oh my God. Yes,
yeah, that guy was.
He's a major fan.
He had every major fan.
Yeah,
and then it was like. You know, I'm trying to do other things, and he keeps talking to me. And I tell you the truth, I had the hearing aids in.
You couldn't hear a freaking
word
he was
saying. I couldn't understand
the
word he was saying. He's from like hillbilly town.
Yeah, pretty you know? Southern sounding. Yeah,
I couldn't understand him at all. Mm-hmm. Just like, you guys ever watch this Ted Lasso on? No, I guess not. It's a Southern guy from Atlanta or somewhere south. He goes to England to coach. He's an American. Football coach. He goes to England to coach a soccer team. Between the English accent and his Southern accent, you got to have the captions on there. You don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, it was interesting hearing him say, Carmine.
Oh, man. I had to do this yesterday. After a while, I was talking to the guy for a while. I was trying to be nice, you know.
Yeah.
So after a while, I said, oh, man, I got to get back to my business. I went, excuse me.
Fake phone call thing.
And I went over to Vinny. I'm talking to Vinny. I said, I have to do this. And then Leanne,
your assistant.
My what?
Your escort.
My escort. Said, oh, he's got other things to do now. And he said, okay, Carmine, I'll see you.
Well, Carmine, we have a surprise for you. We have him here in the back.
Let's bring him out, folks.
Come on out.
Yes. Accompanied by an angry, balding man.
Right.
Oh, that was the other guy. Actually, we have him, too.
Yes.
You guys, both of you, come out.
Which guy? Another guy?
Carmine, this is your weekend.
This is your life.
Yeah, what's that guy's name?
I can't remember his name.
Yeah. Have you seen him before?
No, I met him for the first time yesterday.
I brought him in, huh?
You brought him in.
Yeah.
It's your fault.
One of my
fans. He was enthusiastic. Well, with the Drum Wars thing, let me ask you, so since you're working on each other's material with that, what stuff do each of you, what particular songs do each of you respect the most of what each other has done?
Mm. Well, for me, one of my favorite songs, two, with Dio, was We Rock, Stand Up and Shout.
Yeah.
I love those, and he played his butt off on that. You know, and when we play together, when we do Stand Up and Shout together, you know, Vinny starts, he starts, and then I join him. When the two drums are going, playing that same kind of groove, it's just like a freaking, it's like a locomotive.
I really can't think of any.
We Rock was my wedding song.
Yeah, Camp.
Oh, really?
He kicked ass. Blue Murder and and then the original Keep Me Hanging On.
Yeah,
fantastic.
That was like the one thing I impressed my mother with this weekend, because she came out for a few minutes and she's always like, I've never heard of any of these people you have. And I was like, well, you've heard of Carmine. She's like, I know that name from somewhere. I was like, do you remember the song You Keep Me Hanging On? I love that song. I was like, that was his band.
Yeah.
So I was like, I finally impressed my mother thanks to you.
It's taken all these years.
My fans span generations.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now it's like, my grandfather loves you guys.
Right, yeah. Right.
Cool. You had to play these places, and a really nice chick comes
really
out.
Really funny. I had lunch
My grandfather loves you guys.
I had lunch with Pamela Dubois, right?
Did you?
Pamela was a wild groupie in the 70s and 60s. And we're talking about, I said, you know, it's really changed. I said, I used to go like hang out with my rocker friends and say, hey, man, did you have fun last night? Did you meet some hot chick and blah, blah, blah? And did you smoke some pot, you know? No, man, we took some acid. I said, now I talk to my friends. I said, how's it going? Well, I just got my new blood pressure pill. I'm on 2 cholesterol pills. And she goes, look at this. And she pulls out a bag of vitamins. I said, wow, have things changed.
Yeah.
You know?
Little blue vitamins.
Hilarious.
She was a groupie.
Little blue vitamins.
Now she takes vitamins.
That's too funny.
Anyway.
I'm hogging the questions.
That's awesome. So you guys, I mean, everybody that loves and appreciates these guys, I think over the years with bands, you think everybody, the common thing is, oh, the lead singer is so flashy and the guitar player, look what he can do. But if you really love music, you really love rock music, you understand how important a rhythm section is to a band and how that really makes or breaks a band. It doesn't matter how good the singer and the guitar player is without the backbone. If the almighty power came down to you guys and said you may choose only one bass player to share your rhythm section power with, who would you choose from your careers?
What'd you say after if?
If you had to choose. Yeah.
Hey.
I told you were going to get your balls busted today, Aaron.
Oh, now the crickets are here.
What was that thing from yesterday, that line that we had at Sandy's house? Huh? The line. That line that Bob Kulick said, what gives you the right to ask him that question?
That sounds like a Bob Kulick interview I've had.
What's the name of that band? And the big lawyer
Blackjack,
from New York.
Blackjack. Blackjack.
Yeah. And the big lawyer, they had a meeting and said, I got Ted.
Tom. Let me tell a story, Vin. I got Tom Dowd. To produce you guys, in the band was Michael Bolton, uh-huh. Sandy Gennaro, this guy.
Bruce Kulick,
Bob Kulick, and Jimmy Haslip, tremendous, really great bass player. And this guy, Steve Weiss, was my lawyer for a while. He ripped Vanilla Fudge, Led Zeppelin, Jeff Beck Group, The Rascals, The Yardbirds. You know, just went on and on. He's a real powerful guy. So he got them a deal on Polydor, you know, and he brought everybody in. You know, he brought everybody in. So they had a meeting, and the lawyer says to everybody, I got Tom Dowd, who's a major producer, to produce you. And, you know, Bob thinks he's a producer. And he goes, what gave you the right to get a producer for us? Right?
Wow.
So the whole night at Sandy's house.
Well, then the next thing was he was out of the band.
He was out of the band.
But the rest of the night was, he goes, do you want some coffee? Take sugar. What gives you the right to tell me ask me if I want sugar?
It was hilarious.
Everything was what gives you the right, and we were cracking up.
But anyway, answer his question.
God bless.
What's
Bob Kulick.
Bass players?
Bass player. If you could only have one, the one that you clicked with better than anybody ever.
Geezer Butler.
Yeah! I knew that.
Wow.
Geezer rocks. Geezer's a busy bass player,
yeah.
So I calm down a little bit when I play with Geezer, you know, as opposed to when I played with Jimmy Bain and Dio, he kind of pedaled along, kind of shit.
So he's got two, really.
Two, but I'd say Geezer Butler and
I can't pick. I got
the difference of them, between them, you know.
You got two. All right, what are the two?
Tim Bogert.
Of course. Yes.
Absolutely.
And Tony Franklin.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and Tony. Yeah.
Tony's like I said, Tim Boga's like high energy, Giza.
Yeah.
And Tony Franklin is like Jimmy grooving, but except like the fretless, man. The fretless just sings.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Those are my two favorite. And Tim's gone now, so,
right.
You know, I've done a lot of work with Tony. He's awesome.
Yeah, Tony's great.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's a good question. So, can we get any tour stories? I mean, like, is there any particular interesting, is there any tour, like, is that, we're Kiss fans, so we hear about Kiss getting thrown off of tours earlier in their career. Were you ever on a tour where you got thrown off or, like, upstaging the band you were opening for?
Actually, we did get thrown off the 10 Years After tour with Cactus.
Yeah?
Yeah, we were killing them every night, you know, and after a while, we were gone. Yeah.
We got kicked off the Cactus tour because we were showing them up.
Oh, really?
Every night.
That happened, you guys. Huh? You never got thrown off a tour. Seriously. I mean, seriously.
No, we never got thrown off a tour.
No.
Oh, okay.
We were the tour. That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I did get in trouble one time. It was with Black Sabbath after I joined. It's been about 3 months into the tour. Playing some outdoor show, and this is on the Heaven and Hell album tour, outdoor festival, and Johnny Van Zant's opening. You know, he's the opener. And so what used to happen is we'd arrive at the gig. We wouldn't do a sound check. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to get up. Yeah, there's a big curtain with their logo, their backdrop, Johnny Van Zant. And they're playing, and I go with my guy and go up on the drums and just make sure everything was right and tap them, you know. So then the next thing you know, they're complaining that I was playing during their set, you know. But I was like, ding, ding, ding. I wasn't playing like this, you know. But yeah. They made a big stink, and then we threw them off the tour. We were the headliners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then one time with Motorhead, it was Dio, Motorhead, and somebody else. And remember Vito DeVito, drum tech?
Yeah, the drum tech.
Pretty crazy dude. He comes up in the dressing room. It's Motorhead, and this one, Dio, got smaller. We were open. There was three bands, then somebody, Dio, and Motorhead. And he comes, he goes, hey, Vinny, they want to borrow. Motorhead needs one of your cases, my road cases for something. I said, what? It's Motorhead. They don't have their own fucking cases, you know? I said, fuck that. Fuck them. You know, just meaning, like, you know, New York. Hey, fuck up. And he goes and tells Lemmy, Vinny said, fuck you. I go, what?
Sure, that went over.
Now it comes back. Here's big. The funny thing is, here's big badass Lemmy, right? The radical dude and the rebel. And they come in and go, Lemmy's not going to give you the lights because you said, fuck you to the band. You have to go apologize to Lemmy. I sat there and went, big badass Lemmy? This guy, you know, God, he could chew the Jack Daniels bottle after it's finished.
Right. Yeah.
I got to go apologize for this? He stupid started this shit, you know? So I went in the dressing room. Hey, Lemmy, hey, sorry about that. I don't know what he was on about, but it was just a big mix-up. And I just said, hey, you don't fuck it. Like, you know, I'm from New York. Oh, man, that's cool, man. And it was fine.
You got the lights back.
Yeah, I got the lights back.
That's funny, though. Would you imagine, like, Lemmy kicking in the door? What? You know, like,
no, you see these guys. You go, man, he's badass. I need an apology.
Yeah.
Please apologize.
Or no lights.
But he was, you know, he was cool, and he's good friends with cool Ronnie guy. And stuff. Yeah. This guy just started trouble, you know.
Yeah.
But I thought that was so funny.
That's funny.
I should have filmed it.
Yeah.
I'm going into Motorhead's dressing room to apologize to Lemmy now.
Yeah. So
check it out.
Could you imagine
one time? Wait,
no, go ahead.
I'm gonna tell stories. That's what you want to get.
Yeah. No, go for it.
Story.
Yeah.
Please.
We used to get all sorts of food backstage with Dio, right? So. Used to get a lot of meatballs and pasta, you know. Ronnie and I are Italian. And so one time we left, like, one meatball left in the thing. And we planned the whole thing, and one of our crew came in and he ate the meatball. And then I waited about 10 minutes, and I come and go, where's the meatballs? And Ronnie, oh, shit, he did. And we filmed it, and I started, what the fuck? Are you fucking my meatballs?
It was my meatball.
And the kid was almost crying. My fucking meatball, man. You fuck. Did shit like that. One more dressing room food story. in the first Dio tour or second tour, so we got all the food. We get a lot of Indian food and Italian food. And back then, it was like party time. After the show, we go back to the dressing room, and there's plenty of booze and food. And everybody would come in, guests, the record company. There'd be 20, 30 people in the dressing room. And then finally, when the night went on, they'd leave. We'd go, man, I'm starving, you know, and everything was gone. I mean, holy shit, there's nothing to eat. I said to Ronnie, I said, dude, let's put price tags on everything and see what happens. So the next night we put one meatball, $5.
Yeah.
Curry, $7.50. Beer, $3.
Oh, man.
Peanuts free. Next day, nobody touched anything. Dressing room was full.
That's great.
Nobody ate our food. I mean, it was so funny.
Except for the peanuts.
But we didn't care about that.
That's great.
That's awesome.
So what'd smart.
I said, so I would do that trick every time then, so I will have food left.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we made a bit of money, too.
I put the jar
$23 at the end of the night. How much is a sandwich? You asked me, how much is the sandwiches? Well, what do you have?
How much you got?
Cheese? Is that with cheese? 10 cents more with cheese.
Too funny.
But that did it.
That's awesome.
That's funny.
Yeah.
What's the biggest crowd you think you've played in front of in your career?
Right here.
Right here.
Yeah.
No, okay.
This is impressive.
It's a small crowd, but these guys are the.
Yeah.
That's right.
Like quantity versus quality. This is quality right here. You guys are awesome.
What'd you play to?
Me probably was the Isle of Wight with Cactus. Jimi Hendrix is the headliner.
Wow.
And it was one of his last gigs, actually, and it was 600,000 people.
Wow.
And when it gets that big, you don't even see anybody. I mean, you see the first 50 or 60 rows of people in front of you, and then it becomes like a painting.
Right.
Now, the only good thing is, I remember we, you know, a lot of when we, those kind of festivals in those days, you just sit on the floor. They bring blankets and just sit down. And then my singer said, come on, get up, let's boogie. And the whole place got up, and it was like a gigantic wave. Like,
wow.
And all the way back, I said, wow, that was unbelievable.
Mm. You know? I played with Black Sabbath to 601.
Exactly, 601
the next day.
People.
One extra person in there. Yeah.
In an arena across town while they were playing.
Yeah, but with Rod Stewart, we used to play with huge, unbelievable crowds, you know, like.
Has he been like that his whole life?
His whole life. He's been practicing to be a comedian stand-up.
This stuff just comes to my head. I don't know what it is. Like the thing with the sticks with, you know, I play with the butt end. And then they asked me at the clinic. This was in South America. I go down to South America, and I'm do a drum clinic. So they drive me to the drum clinic. And parts of South Brazil are pretty scary. You know, and it's like 6 at night. You pull up to this road, and the metal gratings are down. There's nobody on the street. And it's getting dark. Yeah. There's graffiti. And we pull up. I don't know where the clinic's going to be. This looks like. Like, I'm going to get killed. So the guy goes, wait here, I'll be right back.
Oh, no.
I go, what? I have no idea where I am. I don't have a cell phone back then. And I'm going to wait here? So I wait there. Then he comes in and goes, okay, come on. And I go in, and it's this nice little theater. Everybody was cool. So I'm playing, and then one kid asks, why do you play with the butt end of the stick? And it just came to me, and I turned it around. I said, because this side, gotta wait, is for girls. And they started cracking up. And there was a language barrier. But all this crazy stuff just comes to my head. And I'm not on drugs.
I remember we did clinics in South America with Michael Badio, the guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
And same thing. We pulled up to this venue. They had a gate. The guy had a machine gun.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I said, what's going on here? You know, what were we in, like World War III? And they said, oh, it's dangerous around here. And then again, you walk in, it's a beautiful theater, you know.
I wouldn't think of it. It's a deserted street. One time we
played. Well, let me tell a funny story before we go.
I'm on a roll.
On that same tour, right?
They had no air conditioning. It was like they had about 1,000 people in for this clinic thing with Michael Beatty and stuff. It was really hot in the venue. It wasn't air conditioned. So, you know, we had to do a break, right? They wanted us to do a break in between. So we come off stage, we're sweating like fuck. So we said to the guy, can you bring a couple of fans? So he comes back with two girls. So no, not fans, fans.
Well, that's better than I asked one. I got a hairdryer brought to the room. I said, can you give me a fan? It's fucking boiling in it. And it comes up with a hairdryer. I got a fan.
Wow.
Shit. That's funny.
You guys talk about sketchy situations, but over the years, I mean, have you ever been in a situation in your heyday, you know, bigger bands, bigger shows, where you were legitimately terrified for your lives? Like, have you ever been in situations like that?
Not me.
I have.
Never. Oh, actually, one time when we played Milwaukee on the Heaven and Hell tour back in 1980 with Sabbath, and we started playing, and two or three songs in, somebody threw, this is when they allowed people to have glass beer bottles, and they threw a bottle on stage, a geezer Butler in the head.
Oh, wow.
And he started bleeding. And Ronnie got fucking pissed off and stopped the show. You fucking assholes. He starts, we're out of here, man. And we got off the stage, and people started going boo and crazy. Then they started throwing stuff. They were throwing chairs. They broke the whole arena up.
Oh, wow.
And then we're backstage. They go, we got to get you guys out of here. They're trying to get back here. And it was a little scary, you know. I thought, what, are they going to kill the band?
Right.
But it was scary enough. The cops came. We got to get you guys out of here. But they're blocking the door. They're blocking this. And it was on CNN. It was all over the news. It was, like, insane. And then finally we got in some sort of vehicles and got out of there. Yeah. We never went back on because everything was destroyed.
I had one in Germany with Cactus again and Jimi Hendrix. That was his last gig, supposedly. And it was the German Hell's Angels are called the Rockers. And for some reason they were tearing the place up and they had machine guns. And so we're in the dressing room. All of a sudden we hear boop, 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 boop. Now, manager Phil Basile comes in. He was a mafia guy anyway. He comes in. He goes, let's get the fuck out of here. I said, what's going on? He goes, those fucking assholes, they got fucking machines gun, and they're shooting everything up. So I remember we're running, we're like ducking between cars to avoid bullets.
Wow.
We got in two Mini Coopers, and we whizzed out of there. And I thought Hendrix went out there, too. You know, I thought all the bands were, like, getting out of there. And was Kristen from one of the podcasts, the guy that owns Pantheon.
Oh, yeah, Christian Swain, yeah.
And he did a thing about Hendrix, and he talked about that. And I said to him, I said, dude, I don't think you're correct. I was there.
Oh, wow.
I said, I don't think Hendrix went back on. I said, we all got out of there. You know, I don't think Hendrix was going to go back and play. Mm. You know?
Yeah, you wouldn't think so.
Not after machine guns.
No.
Hell no.
Unbelievable. That was really ridiculous.
So you worked with Hendrix at the very end of his life. So did you get to know him pretty well at the time?
Yeah, I knew him before he was Jimi Hendrix.
Oh, really?
Jimmy James used to play the clubs in New York.
Nashville, too. He was here for
a long
time. But,
you know, another time, sort of like Vinny, we were playing with Jeff Beck in Berlin. And, you know, we used to have two American flags and the British flags as our background. You know, as a backdrop. And we stopped playing, and they kept yelling out, take the flags down! Take the flags down! And Jeff kept saying, we're not being political. That's where we're from, you know? It's just our backdrop, you know? And I was mostly the front man in that band from the drums, and I'm telling, relax, it's, you know, they don't mean anything. So then somebody throws a bottle, throws it, and it sticks into the shell of my tom-tom. Right?
Wow.
And that pissed me off, man. I said, what the fuck is wrong with you assholes? You know? Next thing we know, take the flags down, and Jeff says, you can go fuck off. And we walked off the stage. I had one of these big Afghan coats, you know? And all of a sudden, every bottle in the place was thrown at the stage.
Oh, shit.
You know? And then another one hit my tom-tom. And I was ready. I saw the guy that drew it. I was ready to run out and kick his fucking ass, you know.
Wow.
And my roadie's playing, get back here, get back here. And same thing, we got you know, we were in the dressing room, and they tore the whole place up.
Yeah.
You know, it was all over the news in Europe, you know. And we never went back there.
That's why there's no bottles at shows, which is smart.
No, that's good.
You get hit with a plastic cup, it's like, hey, stop that. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, I've heard some stories about bands having firecrackers thrown up on stage. Has that ever happened to you?
Firecrackers?
Yeah.
No, no. I never had firecrackers.
But in England, when you went over there with a new band, they would spit on you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I heard they were supposed to.
That meant they liked
you. They liked you, yeah. I've heard about that.
You know.
Really?
Loogies and everything, man. Whatever came out went on the stage.
I didn't know that.
It's a strange way of saying
they liked you. All the time. But Dio, we went over the first time, we got
and they were spitting at you?
Great respect. No. They didn't dare spit on us.
That didn't sound right.
I've seen it before. You're spitting on these poor
guys. I never went over there with a band that was spit on.
Yeah.
I have to say.
Wow. Yeah, I've heard of that before, though. So we talk about, like, scary shit getting thrown up on stage. What's the craziest thing you've ever seen somebody throw up on the stage?
Throw up?
Throw up, yeah. Not counting the band members. But
somebody threw
from
something
the audience
up.
Yeah.
I remember being on tour with KGB with Joe Cocker, and every time there was a solo, he was throwing up in a basket on the side of the stage. He was like still doing heroin.
Well, that's a different throw.
Different throw.
Yeah, that's.
He means throw. We've had you know, underwear and bras and panties and pot.
Hey, let me tell you what.
When the pot came up back then, when it wasn't legal, Ronnie, get the pot.
The pot.
Her bag there.
Oh, no, I got the one for the pot.
Rainbow in the Dark.
Yeah.
Kicking it over to get
I got the one.
Stage.
We were playing Manchester with BBA and having a great show. And somebody throws up one of their big fat joints. So one of our road crew picks it up, you know, and takes a hit. The other road guy takes a hit. Tim Bogart walks over, takes a hit. And while Jeff's doing a solo, I went over and took a hit. And then playing the show, and then I'm looking, where's the freaking roadies? You know? Where'd the roadies go? So we stopped the show. Uh-huh. Yeah, we finished the show. We get off, and Jeff's manager, who is a lawyer, says, I said, where the fucking roadies? He says, oh, sorry, darling, they've been arrested.
Oh, no.
For smoking hash and pot on stage. And you and Tim are arrested, too, but they're letting you finish the encore.
Oh!
I said, get the fuck out of here. You're kidding me. He says, no, it's true. So I said, so we went up, finished the encore. Sure enough, we come out, and two bobbies, cops, were waiting for us. And but first, we went in the dressing room, and you know, we dried off, and we said to them, would you like something to eat? To the cops.
Yeah.
And he says, no, we're okay. And we got changed. And they walked us over to the police station. And we got booked. After we got booked, then they offered us something to eat. Right? It was the weirdest thing. And then like a month later, we had to go to court in Manchester. And we got a conditional discharge, which meant in 12 months, if we didn't get busted again, we wouldn't go to jail. And, you know, we left. We went back to New York. We weren't back there again. And it was unbelievable, you know? It's like, you've been busted, but they're letting you finish the encore.
That's funny.
Can you imagine that in New York or Chicago or something? Forget about it.
Forget about it.
It was so polite. Anyway.
You guys have any questions?
I do.
Yeah?
You would.
I thought you were going to hear from me.
Give it a mic so we can
hear
it.
Let's do this.
I don't have my hearing aids.
Pass it around like a joint at a vanilla fudge show.
Yeah.
What was your guys' first drum set? Like, when you very first started playing, like, you were interested, and maybe you didn't have the best set, but what was that? What did it look like? And
okay. Well, it has to start with me.
Yeah,
okay,
start with him.
Both of you.
Because we have, actually, on my father's side of the family, 7 drummers. Okay. And all of them but one has the last name A-P-P-I-C-E, Cousin Tommy.
God knows what he would call it. Apache.
Yeah, right? So my cousin Joey had the first set of drums. Well, no, he wasn't Apache or the piece. He was Verdi.
Yeah, he wasn't.
So every time I used to go to his house, Vinny wasn't even born yet, he'd have the drums. And I'd get on the drums and start playing. And then I'd go home and I'd take out the pots and pans and start banging on the pots and pans, drive my mother crazy. You know, and then finally they bought me these toy drum sets, you know, for Christmas. And I'd have them for about 2 days, and they were destroyed. You know, because in those days, the toy drum sets had paper drum heads. It was really bad. And then, you know, this kept going on for years. So finally, my birthday is in December, and 10 days before Christmas. So at one time, I must have been 11 or 12, my parents said, how would you like to get a real drum set for your birthday and Christmas? I said, great. So we went to the first Sam Ash store in Brooklyn, and way on top of the shelf was a snare drum, a bass drum, and a cymbal. $55. Right? So we bought it. And I was like, wow. Huh? No brand. It was just...
brandless.
Yeah, it was brandless. It had a cymbal stand that, you know, attached to the cymbal with a clip. The cymbal was that big. You know? But to me, it was like, great. And my grandfather, we lived in my grandfather's house. He was a shoemaker. So he had downstairs a little shoemaker shop. So I took one of their tables, their classic old, you know, dining room tables, and I put it on bricks or cinder blocks, and I made a little stage and put the drums on there, and I go down there and I play. And in those days, you didn't have a record player, the portable record player, and I'd listen to something, I'd play it, copy. My first album was Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, you know, and that's what I listened to, and I was trying to copy. And my grandfather would be in there banging the shoes, and I'm trying to play this thing. I said, hey, Grandpa, can you play in this tempo? Yeah. You know? And he start cursing at me in Italian, and they go upstairs. And then I continue. And then I got a real drum set, and I started playing. I had a band, and we played a gig, and there was one guy that did a solo that was awesome. So I said, man, how did you get so good? He says, I studied with this guy, Dick Bennett. I said, wow, give me his number. So I got his number, and I went to Dick Bennett, and I was like down here, this guy was up here. And man, I went in 6 months, I just passed this guy, I just got so good. And then it was great, and I started playing. And then when he was born and he's growing up, and so then he's watching me, and I think after a while I made it. And then I got a cousin Frankie that played, cousin Anthony that played, my cousin Tommy that played, cousin Joey, you know. My son even plays. Remember the time Nick started playing? We said, who the hell's playing the drums? My son didn't know he can play. Now, anyway, so he's growing up, and I left the drum set home. And, you know, I used to pull into Brooklyn with my full stage gear on, driving my Pantera, you know, in Brooklyn. Yeah, it's very rare. I pull in front of the house, park at the Johnny Pump, right? Yeah. And I walk in, and all the neighborhood kids would come in, and Vinny and... You know, and they Curry Carmine's there, you know, blah blah blah. So then,
the big Vinny rock grabs star.
Me. Vinny grabs me by the seat of my pants. Says, "Come check this out." So he gets on the drums. I left the drum set at home. My Vanilla Fudge kit, right?
It was Gretsch.
Gretsch kit.
Red Sparkle.
Red Sparkle kit.
Great kit to have
and
now.
And he sits down. And he starts boom boom bah, boom 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 boom. He's playing. I said, "Holy shit!" I said to my mother, "Who taught him that?" He goes, "He's there every day for hours. He's driving me crazy like you did." And that was it. So what do you think? I said, well, he sounds good. Well, what should we do? I said, send him to Dick Bennett, the teacher. So he went to the same teacher. And he got good. By the time he was 12, we were listening to Billy Cobham exchanging riffs, you know.
Thing is, went for lessons for 3 years, right? The kids today don't have the patience for this.
No.
All on the pad, pretty much, except for a jazz book we started, Jim Chapman's classic. It's a classic book. And we'd go on the drum just for that, then back on the pad. Most first 2 years, all pad.
Yeah.
You know, wow. The kids today, that's so, the attention spans is big.
Yeah, like School of Rock.
Can't do it on the School of Rock. You go in, they're smart because they teach the kids a song.
Yeah, they teach a song.
Because the kid doesn't have, they don't know what they're playing.
No.
They can play, I can play this, you know. They don't know.
It's like a lot of master classes and clinics today. You go to a clinic, the guy gets up there, and he's like the young kid that played, he just plays the whole time like that. Stops, goes, any questions? No. And continues to play. See ya, thank you. And you walk out, you don't learn nothing. Yeah. You know? I mean, we're from the school of, like, if you're going to do a master class, just trying to teach something, you know? Right. That's what it's about, education.
You gotta, you know,
keep it going.
Play it,
you know?
Slow. Yeah. This is four notes, like I did before on my thing. I did three notes. Check it out. Boom, boom. Yeah. And then you build it into this. Holy shit. Only if you make the face.
Yeah. And it,
well, let's yeah. talk about, let's. I have it.
But the first drum set was.
Yeah, let's talk about my drum set that I left home.
Yeah, Gretsch.
Right? So I got a Ludwig endorsement, so I got this maple kit that looked like that.
Like that.
So we had the Red Sparkle kit at home, which I played. You keep hanging on it, right? So Vinny says.
Vinny's thinking, if I take the Red Sparkle off, it's going to look just like his
drums.
It looks
just like that.
Oh.
Right.
So
he took the Red Sparkle off.
I started
off.
Taking the Red Sparkle off, and half the wood came off with
came
it.
Off the, all the wood. He ruined
Holy
the whole
shit.
Kit. And that kit would have been worth a lot of money right today.
Yeah.
And it really pissed me off. But I said, that's all right. I got my new
Ludwigs. And then I thought, what am I going to do? This looks like shit. So I went to the fabric store and bought brown of all colors. Vinyl. Cloth.
And
like
it had a,
looked like a tablecloth.
Oh, wow. But it had a sticky back.
Yeah, like
and
sticky
you stuck
contact.
It right on there.
I put it on there. It had these brown,
when I went home, I
horrible
said,
looking
the
drums.
What happened here?
Uh-oh.
Yep.
I didn't know that was going to come off with it. You can't take that stuff off.
And then,
actually, maybe now, these days,
and this
of that
has nothing to do with drumming, but one time I went on the road and I said, hey, Vinny, I need someone to watch my cat. Can you stay at my house in Long Island? Sure.
So, nice house. So we went to this house, and I brought a couple of friends, you know, and then a couple of friends met us down there. And I used to smoke a lot of pot.
No,
I didn't drink really, but I loved pot, and you know, smoked hash and shit. And we all did. And some of the guys had some lewds and. So we were partying in the house, but we started to destroy his house. It's like,
yeah.
There was one room he had, which was a hippie music room.
It was my room. It was red rug, red walls, red ceiling, with one of those big light globes in the middle,
of the
with
middle
a red bulb
out.
On a dimmer. So when you get it to a certain point, you couldn't tell where anything ended, where the ceiling started or the walls.
Two giant.
So you smoked some joints in there, and it had one of those furry couch things that were on the floor with two giant speakers, like these things on each side.
Big speakers.
You sit in there stoned,
in
and you listen to music.
Wow.
It was like physical.
So that was one room. Yeah. So we're in there. And this friend of mine, Nikki, he's a singer. He's moving and dancing. And all of a sudden, the fucking
globe
crashes
falls
to the floor and breaks. No. I go, oh, fuck.
Shit. So I have a good idea. Let's move the speakers outside on top of the
that's
porch.
No, that's later. So, So I go, oh, shit, he's going to be pissed. And then I noticed that the 76 gas station had a brick wall
with globes every 10, 5 feet. Yeah.
And the lights. And I go, let's go get one of those globes and
oh
we'll
my
put
God.
It back. We'll make it work. So we only had bicycles. All right, and we stole the globe. And we're riding this big globe on the bicycle back to his house. And we put it on. I don't know what we did. And it looked not so bad. You know, smaller.
But it looked fucked.
So that was one room. Then it's like the next day, hey, let's go on the roof and take the sun. You know, the sun was the big thing.
Yeah, I had a porch, an enclosed porch, right outside the window of that room. So not only did they take sun, they took the speakers out. And they were playing it loud. And I got an old lady, a neighbor. You know, and that's how I found out about it.
Well, we put the speakers out there, but then we forgot. And it was nighttime. We're playing the music really loud. And it's going all over the neighborhood. And then all of a sudden, the door knocks. Who's at the police. Oh, shit. Yes. And I explain, well, Carmine's brother. And as soon as I mentioned his manager, Philly Basile, who's mafioso. Yeah,
the mafia guy.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, we're good.
Just keep it down. And they left.
Wow.
So that, and then one day I look out the window, and a friend of mine's vacuuming the lawn. He's just stoned out of his mind. Yeah. And so we kind of screwed up his house.
Yeah.
And I said,
then I came home. I forgot what I did.
We better wax the tile floor. So I don't know how much wax you used back then. So I got the can of wax, you know, go, dun, 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 dun. Is that enough? It's like the Three Stooges. Yeah, oh, a little geez. More.
And wax, it was a black, wax was about black, that thick. Black tile floor.
Wow.
Screwed it all up.
Wow. That
was crazy.
But did they? But
speaking of Phil Basile, the mafia guy, you guys all saw Goodfellas, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Henry Hill, that guy who it was about. He was Philly's buddy. Oh, he used to come to our house.
Wow.
He'd pull up in his Eldorado and say, hey, come on, I got this stuff. It just fell off a truck. He opened his trunk and you got Revox tape machines and fur coats and little TVs. Hey, man, how much are those Revox? There were $700 in the store. How much are those? He goes, $100 each. I said, oh, give me two. I said, is there any warranty, a guarantee? He goes, yeah, a guarantee. If you break it, I'll give you another one. And then that movie came out, and, you know, the other guy, Paulie, the godfather, we met him, too, you know. In Philly, we say, if Paulie invites you to his house, you better go. It's disrespectful not to go. Because there were times when the mafia tried to get involved in Vanilla Fudge and Jimi Hendrix and all the bands, and Philly sat down with Paulie with the other families and worked out a percentage. And then they realized the bands ain't where they should go. They should go to the record companies. So they infiltrated the record companies instead. But so we owed Paulie a favor. So we had to play in his club in Brooklyn, you know, where we normally got 10 or 15 grand that night. We packed the place and played for nothing, you know. And Philly would say, if Paulie invites you to the house, you better go. So one day, me and Vinny Fudge, I had an XKE at the time, and I was driving, and Paulie pulls up in his big Cadillac. Hey, come on, Vinny, come on over to the house. Oh, great. Last place we want to go to Paulie's house, right? Be our luck, what gets raided and get arrested, you know? So we go to Paulie's house, walk in the driveway. He's got guys outside the house with machine guns, you know, one on each side. So I said to Vinny, let's have a drink and get the fuck out of here. So we had a drink, paid our respects. Hey, Paulie, we got to go. We're going to go record. Okay, see you guys. Whew. What an experience. And then when that movie came out, I said, wow. You know? Anyway, so.
Those were the days.
Yeah. Yeah. Sounds like it. Does anybody else have a question for these guys?
Yeah, what happened? We have one question.
We have one question.
Any more questions?
Hey, it's only 2:00, so we're good.
Yeah. I think that's off, actually. Details from the Aussie tour.
The Aussie tour is nothing but bad stories about Sharon.
Oh, I'm so shocked.
Tell them about the White Castle Aussie story.
Oh, okay, about the White Castle. So we played at Nassau Coliseum, and you know, it's my home turf. I lived in New York, and I was living in L.A. at the time, but I had lived in New York, so I knew everything about Long Island. We played Nassau Coliseum, which is in Long Island. And we had a great gig, and it was wonderful. And then me and Ozzy took a limo back to Manhattan. Ozzy goes, oh, man, I'm bloody hungry, mate. I said, oh. He says, anywhere to eat? You know, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. I said, Mom, I don't know. I said, oh, wait a minute. We're going to Queens Boulevard. I said, Ozzy, did you ever have a White Castle? I said, no, what's a White Castle? He goes, oh, it's a little hamburger. He goes, oh, no, I love hamburgers. I said, okay. So at the time, I had really black and wild purple hair. You know, at times I walk into the hotel and they think I was Ozzy Osbourne because my hair was so crazy, you know. So we pull up in a limo to White Castle. I get out. It's in wintertime. I got a black fur coat on with black and purple hair. Ozzy's got a mink coat on with his blonde streak hair. We still have our eye makeup on from the show. And we walk into White Castle, and we order, I don't know what we ordered. So I said, I think we better get it to go. And there was all these not very nice-looking people in there. So we got it to go. We get in the limo, and we drive back to Manhattan, and we're eating the White Castles and fries and soda in the car. So we had a day off, and then we played Madison Square Garden. So we go get a sound check, and then come back, you know, went to the hotel, come back for the gig, and I go backstage, and the whole backstage is catered with White Castle. He loved it so much that he changed what we ate that night. Everybody ate White Castles.
Right? Thousands of White
Castles. Oh, man, unbelievable.
Wow.
You know, it's awesome.
It's awesome.
Another quick story of Ozzy is when after I got fired and I was suing Sharon, you know, I put King Cobra together, you know, and we were at Mates. Mates is a place where everybody rehearsed. You know, Dio rehearsed there, King Cobra, and Ozzy was rehearsing there looking for new drummers. He already been through one drummer after me, Tommy Aldridge, and then he fired Tommy and they were looking for somebody else. So I had this huge deal with Capitol Records for King Cobra, you know, record deal, publishing deal, merchandise deal. I had, you know, a lot of money to spend. So I bought a truck, I bought a mobile home, a motor home, and I bought a van. I bought my father's van, actually, from my father. And I wanted to paint it all white, you know, so everybody looks uniform. So I'm in the Mates parking lot because we're rehearsing there, and I had five roadies, and they were painting. One of them was an auto painter. So we were painting the motorhome, I keep getting mixed up, the motorhome, white. So I'm up there, I'm a little ladder, and I'm putting up the paper on the windows so the windows wouldn't get sprayed. So Ozzy's rehearsing, you know, audition. He comes over, hey, Calm, how are you? I says, I know you're having problems with my missus, but I hope we can be friends. I said, hey, Oz, I know it's not you. We're good. She goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm putting this up so I can paint it. My roadie's going to paint it. He goes, you need any help? I go, sure. So I put Ozzy up on this little step ladder. I shouldn't have done it because, he, you know, I didn't know what condition he was in. And I'm on one side. He's on the side of his double window. And we're putting this thing up. He said, so what's this for? I said, this is my, instead of renting a bus, I bought this motorhome. You know, this way I always have it, and I don't have to worry about renting a bus. So it was my new band, King Cobra. I said, we're about to go in and run through the set. You want to hear some of it? He goes, sure. So we run in, and one of the first times we ran in the whole set, we had a stage set and everything. And we walk in, and Ozzy was our only audience.
Wow.
Right? And you know, we ran through about three or four songs. And he's waving, I got to leave. I said, okay. So he comes up and goes, I like the band. I like the band. That's funny, though. Yeah.
It's awesome.
Anyway.
Cool.
Any other questions for you?
Bonham? I mean, we took Led Zeppelin on the first tour. Nobody knew who Bonham was. You know, it's hard to believe. He was like unknown.
They didn't know who Zeppelin was.
Yeah, they didn't know who Zeppelin was.
Didn't they boo them when they...
Yeah, on the first show, they booed him off because they weren't beyond. It was a show with Vanilla Fudge and Spirit. It was in Denver, 8,000 people sold out. And my agent said to the promoter, come on, Barry Fay is the promoter. It's Jimmy Page's band, $1,500, Led Zeppelin. It's a new band. I don't need them. We're sold out. I'll tell you what. You play $750, Vanilla Fudge will play $750. Okay, so we ended up paying them to be on our show. They came on, they played, and they started getting booed. Bring on the fudge, you know, and stuff like that. But I saw Bono play. I said, man, he's awesome. I loved him, you know. And I was always the kind of guy, like, you know, that the roadie, I'd hang out with the road crew, the opening band's road crew, the different drummers, you know. But I really liked
it. Then a little later on, you saw Robert Plant and told him what he should do on stage?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was funny. And they played a bunch of gigs with us. But I really liked Bonzo. And then we're walking to Santa Monica Boulevard with me and Tim Bogan and Robert Plant. And I said to Robert, I said, you know, you should move around a little more. It'll be better if you moved around a little more.
If you don't move around, you might not get anywhere.
Think about it now. He never moved, you know. It's funny, right? But anyway, so then, you know, Bonzo saw my big drum set that I had, the maple kit that Vinny liked that he tore my drums apart for.
I could have worked on his, too.
Yeah. And he had this little Ludwig kit like the one that, except I had the 26 bass drum that Vinny ruined. That was the first 26 bass drum in rock that Vinny ruined. Anyway, so he said, man, I would love to get an endorsement and get a drum kit like that. I said, oh, let me see what I can do for you. So I called Ludwig and I said, there's a new band. I'll send you the record. John Bonham is his name. Great band, Led Zeppelin, Jimmy Page band. He's got a great foot on his song, Good Times, Bad Time. You know? I think they're going to be big.
The understatement
of five decades. Right? And then when I met Bonzo, I said, man, I love that Good Times, Bad Time thing. It's awesome. Where'd you get that? How'd you think of that? He goes, I got it from you. I said, no, I don't do that. And he pointed out on one record that I did, I went like bop, 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 like that. I didn't continue it like he did. He said, so I got that, and I just kept doing it. I kept repeating it, and I kept practicing until I got it. I said, dude, where did I do that? It's like I said before, I just play a record. I don't know what I did. And he pointed it out on the Vanilla Fudge record, which I don't remember now, which I think was Renaissance. Mm-hmm. He pointed it out exactly on the song, you know, because we had record players that we took on the road. And he played it for me. He said, right there. I said, wow, I didn't even know that, you know. And then he came out, and next tour, they got so big so fast, he had the same drum set as me. And then we were alternating bill. That means some gigs I would open with the Fudge, some gigs he would open with Zeppelin. So I always thought how funny it looked for the audience. No matter who opened up, let's say Fudge opened up, I'm playing my drums, they take my drums off, and then they bring his drums on. It's the same drum set.
Did he use double bass then?
Yeah, he used double bass then.
Double bass for a while.
Yeah, he used double bass on that particular tour. And I said, the audience must think the roadies were crazy. You know, they take one off, exactly the same setup.
You know. And Page and Plant told him he was too busy.
He's too busy.
With two bass drums.
So wow. They said, you got to take one away. When he did
away.
That, the Led Zeppelin drum set was born. Mm. The big drums with one bass drum, you know. And I had the same thing. So you see videos where he's playing a blonde drum set. That's the kid I got for him. You know, and we became friends, you know. And I think I told the story before.
And then he wanted me to recover his old kit. I said, well, you ship it to Brooklyn. I'll take good care of it.
It's funny. One other quick thing with them. We were doing on that tour when he had the same drum set. You know, they were opening up before us. And how many more times they would do this... like Robert Plant and Jimmy Page would do this thing with the bow and the vocals and like for 10 minutes, you know. So Bonzo and Paul Jones would come off the stage. So Bonzo comes up to me, he goes, hey, you want to have some fun? I go, what? He goes, instead of us going up, why don't you and Tim go up? You know the arrangement. I go, yeah, we know the arrangement. We've seen it enough. He says, all right, so you go up and we'll see if they even know the difference. You know? Okay. So we sneak up, and we know when the cue is. So I go, so Robert starts singing, and he looks over, and goes like, he goes over the page and elbows him, and he goes, look at he looks at him, there's me and Tim playing the song, and the audience loved it. So then we went on, and when we played Shotgun, they all came on and jammed with us.
Oh, that's
Bonzo
cool.
Was playing the floor tom-tom next to me. You know, Mark Stein had Jimmy Page playing the organ with him. Jimmy Page had his amp on the stage, so he just plugged into his amp. And it was great, you know. And Robert Plant sang with Mark and Vinny,
wow.
Whoever sang the song, Timmy.
That's really cool.
No, it was Timmy sang the song, so Robert was over singing with Timmy.
Do you have a question?
It's great times.
When you use an axis, do you go straight to Dio after axis?
Axis? No, I played with Rick Derringer, and then first I played with John Lennon when I was really young. Did some stuff with John Lennon.
Just tell him that story.
Yeah.
Okay. The way I hooked up with John Lennon is a friend of ours was Jimmy Iovine, who produced Lennon and Beats Audio and Interscope Records. He was a good friend from Brooklyn, and he heard the band. The guitar player was friends with him, so he took us into Record Plant Studios. It was a 9-piece band with 4 horn players. He took us to a record plant. We did some demos. And they liked us so much, the owner of the plant, so signed us to a management deal, gave us to a room on the 10th floor to rehearse. Big room in Manhattan for free. So we had access to it all the time. And so we're up there rehearsing and stuff, and Jimmy was producing John. And the phone rings one night. Hello? Jimmy goes, can you guys come down and do hand claps for this session? Yeah, sure. So we all go down, nine of us. We walk in the studio. It's John Lennon. I'm like, nice. Fuck.
Wow.
Shit. Boom. I'm 16. So I go, holy shit. Let me put the headphones on. Now he's talking to you.
Oh, nice.
Telling you what he's looking for on the song. I'm going, oh, my God. I'm definitely not going to school tomorrow. This is too big. So we did hand claps on the song, Whatever Gets You Through the Night. That's me and my band on that song.
Wow.
And then so we freaked out. You know, we finished. We went and said hi, you know, bump, bump, bump. We didn't get fanboyish with them. And then we left. You know, we went back up to the room. We were freaking out. And next day, I think I didn't go to school. I skipped a day.
Yeah.
I blame it on Carmine. Tell my mother. Carmine said I could skip a day. So then we're playing, and a day or two later, we're playing in the room. And John walks in. He sits down on the steps and watches us rehearse and play. And he really liked us. And holy shit. You know, cramps, you know, when he walked in. You're like, I can't play anymore. Wow. And then we got to start hanging out with them because we never did the fanboy thing. So there was a pool table in the next room. We played pool with them. He felt safe. That's why he kept coming back. Yeah. And he really liked the band. So I'm sitting there. I smoked joints with him. He wanted coke, but I didn't do coke. Mm-hmm. I said, I got this great pot, you know, and roll a joint. I'd smoke with him. And so we're talking about Italian food. So I tell him my family, you know, my grandparents are from Italy. My mother makes a lasagna. Grandma's upstairs making the meatballs. And I said, I'll have my mother make you some, right? And a couple days later, I bring in a tray of lasagna. And I see John. I go, this is for you. This is from my mother. And he takes it. Thank you. Oh, it was great. Blah, blah, blah. And he went away. And then that was that. And then...
And then the story continues. So I'm playing with Rod Stewart five nights at the Garden. And the last night we had a party. The last day, John Lennon and I don't know who he was with, his wife at the time.
May Pang.
Come to the party we had, wherever we had it. And my mother and father came to see me with Rod. So my mother and father came to the party with me. So my mother goes, hey, isn't that John Lennon over there?
I go, my mother's a little, you know, little chubby Italian woman. She didn't.
I said, yeah, that's John Lennon.
Not intimidated.
And I met him that day. You know, I didn't get to know him, but I met him. We talked about, you know, Vinny hanging out with him and stuff. And I said, yeah, that's him. She goes, you know, I made him some lasagna. I never found out if he liked it. I said, okay. I go over there. Hey, John. It's Vinny and my parents, my father, my mother, and Mary and Charlie. And he goes, oh, nice to meet you. So my mother says, oh, yeah, I made the lasagna. I just want to know if you liked it. He goes, oh, with his British accent, I loved it. It was fantastic. So my mother says, could I have my pan back?
And we never got it back.
Never got it back.
We think Yoko's got it.
Yeah.
Wow, right? I couldn't believe it. I was in shock when she said that, man. I went, mom.
Like, I think I'll bring the pan back. Maybe Carmine's, Vinny's mother's going to be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Walks in Madison Square Garden with the pan.
Tell him about the day in school after Lennon.
School?
When you went to school.
So then we started working with him. Yeah, he asked us to do three videos that's on his DVDs with my band. I'm in those. And then he produced the owner of the record plant's wife, eight songs, so as him as a producer. He rewrote some of the lyrics for my band. And so we got to know him really well. Eventually, we did this show in New York City, and it was at the New York Hilton. It was a tribute to Sir Lou Grade. That was a guy in England that was a big entertainment dude, and John didn't like him. He thought he was two-faced. So John said, look, I want you guys to do the show with me, but I want you we're going to make masks of your face and put them on the back of your head with no hair. Mm. And you're going to wear black drum suits. He's going to wear red.
Two-faced.
So next day, whenever the day was, we get in the van with John and go get the faces made. They put wax, you know, casting on your face. We did that. We did got fitted for the jumpsuits with him. He was like hanging out with him. And so I was doing all this stuff with him. And then that show, we did it, and it was taped and broadcast live around the world. Mm-hmm. I found out a couple of years ago that was his last live appearance.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, I did his last live appearance? A kid from Brooklyn? Holy shit. So I used to go into school in between all this the next day, be with him at night, and then go back to school, 16, 16 and a half, and the teacher would be teaching. And while she's teaching, she's hearing, you know.
Banging on the desk.
Banging on the desk. I'm like rocking out. She goes, wait, who's that drumming? Vincent, can you stop that drumming? And I'd stand up and I go, excuse me, did anyone else in this room play with one of the Beatles last night? And I got up and I left.
Nice.
I quit school.
You dropped the mic.
Somebody's going to be saying that about you guys tomorrow morning
when
at school.
When he said a kid from Brooklyn, I got to tell you a really wild story, too. This has nothing to do with John Lennon, but when we played with Rod Stewart in L.A., Rod Stewart always had, we played six nights at the Forum. There was everybody, Tony Curtis and this one, Fred Astaire, Gregory Peck, and all these legendary actors and, you know, Kiss and, you know, Phil Collins. Everybody came to see us. So one day we're there. And I see Gregory Peck and Fred Astaire there. I said, wow, that's unbelievable, you know? So anyway, so we finished the thing. Then Rod gets married to Alana, right? And I went to the wedding party. So pull up. I figured I'm going to, you know, I get pulled up in the Pantera in Brooklyn. I'm going to pull up in my Jag to this wedding party because it's at Alan, the producer of Grease, whatever his name is. You know, he had a big mansion in Beverly Hills. I pulled up in my Jag. I get out, and I'm talking to people. I see this guy walking towards me. He's a big guy. He comes over. And it's fucking Gregory Peck. He comes over, and he puts out his hand. He goes, hi, I'm Gregory. I say, I know who you are. I said, my mother would die if she was here. So he goes, yeah, I'm Gregory Peck. You know, and I was at your show at the Forum. I just want to tell you, you know, I'm sitting with Fred Astaire, and when you did your drum solo, Fred Astaire turned to me and said, this is the greatest drum solo since Gene Krupa.
Nice.
And I said, Fred Astaire said that about me? He says, you know, he's a drummer. I said, I didn't know that. And I'm thinking, fucking Gregory Peck is telling you this shit. You know? So I was like, whoa. So then he said, oh, man, he's a drummer. But he doesn't know how to play this rock stuff you do. I said, wait, I got a book. It's called Realistic Rock. It'll teach him how to play rock. He says, oh, that's great. Why don't you drop it off at my house, Gregory, who lived next door to Rod. He says, next time you're at Rod's rehearsing. I said, okay. So go to Rod's house and rehearse. I get the book. I sign, to Fred, I hope this helps you play rock. Good luck, love you, Carmine Appice. I should have said Appice, but I said Appice. Anyway.
They know the story.
Yeah, we know the story. So they have these gigantic gates in these Beverly Hills mansions, and the doors are huge, you know? So I said, okay. So he said, just ring the bell, I'll buzz you in, you know? I said, okay. So I ring the bell, the gates open, I walk up the hill, to these giant doors, and Gregory comes out, you know, and he's like 6'3", you know. And I say, hi, Greg. Here's the book. He goes, oh, that's great. Fred's going to love it. And I said, wow, okay. So, you know, he gave me a hug. I gave him the book. I go back to Rod's house. I'm like, wow, this is, how cool is this, right?
Yeah,
I just gave Fred Astaire my book. And about 2 weeks later, I get an envelope at Rod's house. This is Ava Productions. I don't know what it was. It had no address or nothing on it. Just says Carmine Appice. And Rod's publicist gave it to me. So I ripped the envelope up. It's a fucking letter from Fred Astaire. He says, Dear Carmine of Peace, thank you for the book with the great message. I've enjoyed your work many times. Love, Fred Astaire.
Wow.
And in my book, I wrote, I was just so blown away. Here I am, a kid from Brooklyn, you know, with Hollywood royalty, getting a letter from him, thanking him to give me my book. You know, I was like, whoa, I made it now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
It's cool to hear that even guys like you have had times in your lives where even you've been starstruck. I mean, everybody does it to you, but it's cool to see that you guys have experienced it too.
It's just like the time me and Vinny smoked a joint with Buddy Rich.
Buddy Rich. Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
That was funny, right? Yeah. Should we tell that story?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. But it started with me. My manager wanted it. Buddy Rich was playing the Starwood. My manager wanted me to play with Buddy Rich and his band. I told him, I don't want to fucking do that, you know? So he talked to the Starwood owner, and he said, yeah, that'd be great. So I don't know what they told Buddy, but anyway, it fell apart. So we said, let's go see Buddy Rich at the Starwood. So we go see Buddy Rich.
That's a club in Hollywood.
LA. Yeah. So we're in the VIP area. So Buddy's daughter comes out, Kathy, so I knew. She says, oh, Carmine, you came? And I said, yeah, I came. Why? He goes, man, my father's pissed at you. I said, why? He says, well, because you challenged him to a drum battle. I said, I didn't freaking challenge him to a drum battle. You know?
Who would do that?
Yeah. Exactly, right?
Oh, thank you.
Did anyone ever hear the Buddy Rich bus tapes? Oh, you ever hear legendary. The bus tapes? Yeah. So it's ridiculous. I said, you know, I'm not going to challenge your father to a drum battle. He's like my idol, you know? So she goes, well, come on in and talk to him. I said, no freaking way, not if he's pissed off at me. I heard the bus tapes.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Right? So she goes, ah, come on, come on. I said, Vinny, you come with me.
Again.
Right? So we both go in and she said, hey, buddy, this is Carmine. He was going to play with you. Oh, you mean like that other asshole, Ginger Baker, challenging me to a drum battle? I said, look, buddy, it's not like that. And I explained to him what happened. He goes, that's it? I go, yeah, that's it. And he goes, you smoke? I said, no, I don't smoke. You smoke? I said, no, I don't smoke. He said, but do you smoke? I said, what do you mean, pot? He goes, yeah. I said, yeah, I smoke pot. And he said, Vinny, yeah, I smoke pot. So he reaches in his pocket. I'll never forget, it was a
big
joint
one
wrapped in chocolate papers. He puts it in his mouth, lights it, takes a hit, hands it to me. I take a hit. I go, I fucking don't believe this. I'm smoking a joint with Buddy Rich. Give it to Vinny. Vinny's thinking the same thing. Right? And then we get smashed.
We're fucking zonked.
Zonked. Buddy goes on, just plays his ass off.
Flawless.
Unbelievable. And we're both sitting there looking at each other. How the fuck is he doing that?
Wow. It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
we got to wind this up. Or?
Yeah.
That's
a great story.
That's a good way to go out, I think.
Late, it's 2:30.
This has been it's actually 4:30. Why don't you guys get a new clock? Yeah, I don't know what's up with the clock. He's going to fix it. But turn it upside down, it'll be closer. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for being a part of this, and thank you guys for coming out for this.
Thank you guys.
Great stories.
Thank
you so much.
We enjoy doing this, telling the story.
We got tons of stories. Yeah. I mean, that's not even the whole. We barely scratched.
Yeah, if you want to hear any more of my stories, I have a book called Stick It, My Life of Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. And you can get it on Amazon. You can get autographed copies on my website. Vinny don't have a book yet.
I'm going to have a book soon, but it's going to be like, and in the 80s, the next page is blank because I forgot. And then a couple of pages, then there'll be a meatball stain. I'm going to put gravy stains on him. Continue it.
Right. And he's not
It's hard to remember all this stuff. All right. Well, thanks, everybody.
Thanks again. Awesome.
Thank you, guys.
Right.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football.
FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.